UCR podcast.
With seven guys, a dozen songs spread across two discs, and a sound big enough to fit elements of rock, jazz, and classical music, Chicago's first album announced the arrival of a band with ambition to spare. Now, that is how Jeff Giles began his UCR piece on Chicago's first album, Chicago Transit Authority, released 55 years ago now. And Jeff joins me alongside UCR's Nick DeRiso. Guys, thank you so much for being here.
You're welcome. Although I have to admit up front, I have no memory of writing that piece that you're quoting. So
that's why I'm always thrilled to bring it up when I find you've written about an album that we're going to discuss. Nine times out of 10, I'm like, I bet Jeff will not remember writing any part of this. And so I am thrilled to hear you say that.
That would make a really good podcast. Let's stump Jeff. What did you say about CTA?
Be stumped every time.
And then have a multiple choice item after it.
Well, I had a conversation with Chicago's Lee Lockdane recently. They have a new release out called Chicago and Friends Live at 55. It's featuring special guests Chris Daughtry, Steve Vai, Robert Randolph. The stuff with Robert is super cool. Chris Stone, Kingfish, Ingram, and others. A set which runs close to 2.5 hours, recorded in Atlantic City. That was a good excuse to get Lee on the horn, no pun intended, because one of the things they did in Atlantic City was they put the spotlight on the CTA album to celebrate its 55th anniversary. That meant that they not only played a lot of songs that have stayed in the set over the years, they also put in stuff like South California Purples and Poem 58 that have not been a regular fixture. So we will hear that conversation with Lee in a bit. But first, guys, I thought we would talk about Chicago Transit Authority a bit, because Chicago was not the first band of horns, but like they established something important with the CTA album, right?
Well, Blood, Sweat, and Tears were a horn band too, but not nearly as accessible. After all, you'll remember their debut album was not only titled Child is Father to the Man, which is super weird. It also featured this great-tastic cover of the band with little mirror image dolls of themselves on their laps, okay? So that was never going to be to one day show up, you know, in the top 10. People are going to run away from the record store aisle where that is featured. So, you know, some fans eventually got turned off by Chicago's drift into the pop mainstream. But they were always known for that accessibility, even going back to CTA. It's far more complex than You Are the Inspiration or any of the other big 80s singles by Chicago. But they found a way to take two things that may have seemed at odds and put them together from the very first in a way that was far more approachable than you might have guessed.
I cannot put it any better than Nick did. That is a perfect way to sum up not only what they did with this record, but what they kind of always were, no matter how much certain fans want to say that they, you know, became a different band or a worse band after Terry Kath passed. They were, yes, what they proved for out the gate was that you could blend all these things in a very accessible way. And it ever has it been thus, you know, that's always been sort of their brief, is to be adventurous in certain ways, but always be radio friendly as well.
This may be similar to what you two have kind of spoken about, like, but what do you think, if we put it in context with their peers who were making music at the time, like, what do you think it was that made these guys stand out?
Hooks, right? It's I mean, there's some weird stuff on this record. I don't ever need to hear freeform guitar again in my life, but Beginnings, that's a great example of just how incredibly accessible their stuff was from the start. And all their records are 2-3 singles deep, and maybe that's because they were so stacked with talent. They had multiple songwriters in the group, but other groups in their peer group, whatever you want to call it, just didn't have the same fastball for radio.
Yeah, one of the greatest parts about this album is you know, speaking of Beginnings, is Robert Lamb was in full creative flight here. This is one of just two albums with Peter Cetera in the lineup where Cetera has no writing credits. Mm-hmm. And when Lamb is hitting on all cylinders like this, Chicago generally is too. There were two top 10 singles and another top 25 single from CTA, all of them written by Robert Lamb. And probably one of the most concerning things to me about the arc of the band was how his creativity, that creative momentum began to slow. I had less of a problem with Chicago becoming more of a mainstream pop act than I did the loss of his voice in the band, because for the entirety of the first 10 years of this group, if when I looked at the liner notes inside, the songs that said Robert Lamb were always the ones that I went, wow, that's the song I like, you know? And I feel like, you know, a song like Does Anybody Really Know What Time It Is, within the context of this album, you know, that's what sold the record. You know, that's what brought people into this mix, you know, and Robert Lamb was the guy who guided folks in, you know, and there were all these interesting things happening with the horns and all these interesting and quite frankly, sometimes weird things happening with Terry Kath. And Robert Lamb was sort of like the train conductor saying, yes, you know, this, sure, that was, we hit a few bumps back there, but you know, it was a little bit windy going through the pass, but it's going to be okay. And, you know, I come back to his songs, you know, questions, beginnings, does anybody really know, over and over again, because they really do. It's like the clouds part of these albums every once in a while. And this great pop confection is there for you. I absolutely love it.
In 92, when I interviewed Peter Cetera, he said something about, he agrees with you, Nick, and he was talking about how in his prime, Lamb was arguably the best songwriter of his generation. And he kind of lamented the loss of that and shook his head and said he didn't know what happened there. And I think he was being a little disingenuous. I mean, Lamb... we are jumping way ahead in the band's history here, but when their sound shifted, he was the odd man out. I mean, at first he was creatively adrift, and then when he started writing again, he was writing things that had no place on a Chicago album of that era.
Yeah, but, I agree. You know, and I think that some of that's been chalked up to any sort of personal problems that he might have been having at the time that kind of took him out of the mix. And it's really kind of, however true that is, that's really disappointing that he was out of the mix long enough politically to kind of lose his spot. And it's like two things kind of happened. It's like he lost his spot,
right?
And in a certain kind of way, it's like there may have been some sort of mojo that was lost that he also was never able to recapture, which is something we see a lot. Although I always love, like, with bands and artists, like we've talked about this a lot. Like I'm never one to count a band out, because just like a band sometimes, or an artist can release, you know, five or six dud records in a row and then just release that record that is great, that you're like, wow, I never would have seen this guy making another good record again, but here it is. So, but I'm glad that you two highlighted these songs on this CTA record, because that's a really good point. Like, does anybody really know what time it is? Beginnings, questions 67 and 68. Like, the thing that I kept coming back to as you guys were talking was, does anybody really know what time it is? Very much like 25 or 6 to 4, I would say. Like, these are quirky songs that in the same way fit with the time period in which they were written. Like, they were less quirky and less weird because of when people were hearing them. But it's kind of like a song title, like, does anybody really know what time it is? It's kind of a interesting thing to build a song around, that whole particular idea. And Lamb was really good at making stuff that would like fall flat and just sound like hippy dippy garbage from any other band. He was really good at like taking stuff like that and just making it soar. And I think that Does Anybody Really Know What Time It is a great example of that.
They were a muscular band. They had a big sound. I think that covers up a lot of those sins that you're talking about. This does not sound like I Gave My Love a Flower or you know, anything like that, even though it is, that early stuff is definitely cut from the same cloth as some of the hippy dippy things that you're talking about. But they had some oomph
And
Beginnings is probably the closest of those three songs to the hippy dippy thing, but he sells it. He makes it work.
Yeah, question 67 and 68. I'm glad you guys mentioned that one too, because that's just that's certainly one of the moments where, you know, Cetera gets to shine early on. But I think that those three songs, and as you said, Jeff, like some of the stuff that Terry Kath did was just so out there. You know, it's like if you listen to like the Chicago at Carnegie Hall box set, especially if you got the one that's been released within the past couple of years that has all the shows, which is just a fascinating ride. You know, we've talked about this before, but I came in first with Chicago 17. So to get the Chicago Transit Authority album, to get Chicago 2, to get that Carnegie Hall box set, and hear this band that could go between so many different styles of songs stylistically, all within the same album or all within the same run of three or four songs at a live show. And then they could just have this moment where it's like they could just go off on like a 23-minute jag was crazy. Like it's something that could only work in the early 70s. And that's why it's been kind of fascinating as they've kind of started to mine their archives a little bit. They put out a show. If folks, you know, dug the Carnegie Hall show or the, you know, Live in Japan show, they put out a show from Washington, D.C. that was from 1971 that was interesting because it was released. The show was recorded, I think, 5 or 6 months after they had recorded Carnegie Hall. So for a lot of bands, like, that's going to be basically the same live album. But it just kind of shows, like, how prolific and how much Chicago was just evolving day by day, week by week, and month by month when you listen to those two live shows. But even if you don't do any of that, even if you're just like, look, all I have patience for is just, you know, pulling up Chicago Transit Authority on Apple Music or wherever you're listening, like, it's a pretty fascinating ride to take with these guys. And the thing I always come back to is that, like, I think it's like the band's first three albums were all double albums. Like, this band on so many different levels should not have worked. This band should have bombed hard. This record, as the first record, should be a record that 55 years later we're still laughing about, just because there were so many things that were just against the odds. But, you know, to the point of what you guys have said, I think that they had a lot of things on their side. Jeff, you said they had a lot of oomph to what they did. You both have talked about, like, how much, like, just commercial stuff they, whether you want to say they snuck it into their songs back then or it was blatant, there was enough commercial appeal there. There were enough hooks. You know, we mentioned question 67 and 68. Like, it's just like songs like that just get into your head. So it's just like, even though it seems like a lot on paper, everything that you got handed with the Chicago Transit Authority album, yes, it's a journey. It's a big, long trip as a record, but I think you can say this for at least the band's first three records. Like, it's a pretty engaging listen.
Well, you had horns in the band, but that wasn't where the jazz influences necessarily came from. That was Danny Serafin. The horn players were melodic. They provided more of an old-fashioned, like, Stax type additions to these songs, where it was another voice, another musical voice, rather than long solos where they got outside. Of course, Kath would do that on occasion, but, you know, that was a stabilizing force there for people who maybe didn't know too much about jazz, but were interested in a more freeform kind of rock. You did not have Coltrane-esque saxophone solos, you know, trying to find God in the face of of all odds on a saxophone. The drumming, I felt like, though, was a different story. Serafin, he really helped lead Chicago into fusion within these songs. There were splashes of old school swing from guys like Gene Krupa, but he had that muscularity that made it work in rock that you heard in jazz players too, like Buddy Rich and Tony Williams. And that powerfulness that he brought to it made him perfect for fusing these rock songs. And You know, they had someone in Kath who could kind of take them to weird places, but there was a lot of modifying forces in this band, not least of which is Peter Cetera's playing and singing, even early on. Having said all that, I still feel like those hooky things that Lamb did were snuck in. I do feel like that he was bringing the band to a certain place that maybe they weren't. I don't know that without his guiding force early on, they might not have tried to get more fusion-y and more weird and more out there. He was such an important force in terms of the songwriting, but I think as players, they benefited from having a real rock solid horn section that wanted to complement what they were doing more so than lead them into jazz with the quotes on either side.
Yes to all of that. Great horn section, underrated rhythm section, phenomenal guitarist, top shelf songwriting. Yeah, I don't know what else there is to say other than if you want to slag what Chicago did in later years, I think the most valid complaint is that in the beginning they were woolly. They were unpredictable. You didn't really know everything that they were going to do from album to album, and later on that spirit was lost. The commercial aspect of things was allowed to completely eclipse everything else. And I don't think it needed to. And I think the greatest missed opportunity in their entire career was probably when they were dropped by Warners in the early 90s, not deciding to go back to some semblance of that earlier sound. They could have played with Fish. They could have played with Dave Matthews Band. They could have played with Blues Traveler. They could have fit right in that entire scene in the early 90s. It was right there. But instead, they decided that they wanted to keep scoring adult contemporary hits for whatever reason. I think there was an opportunity for them to be both things, just like they were in the beginning. They were a rock band that could throw you a curveball every so often, but they were also always relatively radio friendly, and they could have done that again. I don't know why they didn't want to.
Well, the new live record really kind of shows that in action, and you've got Steve Vai stepping in for Terry Kath on this new mm-hmm. live record, and you're thinking, I mean, when I listened to it, that's what you're saying right now is the first thing I thought. Why didn't they do this a long time ago? Why didn't they hook up with a jam band to open, or they could open for someone else if it was a big enough band, get a hotshot guitarist, and go back out there and reclaim the legacy of the Transit Authority era. I guess that wasn't obviously to be, but I think the new album does show you what might have been at times.
100%. That's a really interesting thing to say, because it's just like, I know that Huey Lewis did that. He kind of, before he had his vocal issues that have kind of taken away from touring, he started, kind of going out and, jamming with some of the jam bands. And obviously the person that has, done that to an even greater degree is, our man, Bruce Hornsby, who has become kind of, he's gone from being the way it is guys in the eyes of a lot of folks, which, to be honest, there's still a large segment of people that see him as that guy, but he's become a formidable player on the jam band circuit. And, those are just two examples that pop to mind, but that's a really kind of interesting statement when we look at how some of the veteran bands survived by kind of putting themselves into different scenes than the scenes that they were perceived to be part of. I think one thing that comes to mind for me is obviously, this was not a big leap for Allman Brothers Band to kind of get into the mix of that side of things. But it's like they placed themselves right into that world early on as the jam band festivals started to become more and more of a thing. And it's just like, you're right, Nick. Chicago definitely could have made some sort of play to become part of some kind of festival type of world, some kind of scene in that realm. So that's all three of us can vouch for all three of us that we've all spent a lot of time thinking about the different layers of Chicago and talking about the different layers of Chicago. But I think we can almost wrap it up right there because you've contributed the new original thought of the day. You know, where I want to bring it back to you guys is, like, you both mentioned the Chicago that emerged in the 80s. And the three of us earlier this year talked about what were once vices are now habits by the Doobie Brothers on the Connected Record Player podcast that Jeff and I have been known to do. And what brought that to mind was the idea of how polarizing the OG lineup of the Doobies is compared to the Michael McDonald era. And the same can be said regarding Chicago in the 70s regarding versus Chicago in the 80s. And it's funny, Nick, I didn't have a chance to look for this, but I feel like at some point for UCR, like you even wrote like an article like Chicago in the 70s versus Chicago in the 80s. Like, I know that we've done some of these versus type articles at UCR, but it's
probably,
I mean, it's really interesting to hear you guys talk about that evolution and just to consider how much of that was already present in the Chicago of the 70s. Because for me, as I said earlier, like, you know, when I, you know, took that leap from Chicago 17 and went back to those early albums that I found in a thrift shop, it knocked me back a little bit listening to some of those early Columbia records after I'd been like soaking up the Warner Brothers stuff for a period of a couple of years. But the thing that I thought about as I was getting ready to talk to you guys when it comes to 80s Chicago is that obviously, like, you can find this stuff all over Chicago Transit Authority and all over, you know, some of those Chicago albums of the 70s. But like, just how excited I was where I got Chicago 18 and hearing a thing like Free Flight, which was kind of like this little just instrumental kind of part that popped up midway through the record. And I think why that was fun at the time was because like the horns were so largely missing in action for a good part of that decade. But how do you guys, like, can you guys connect the dots as far as, are there things that Chicago would not have been able to do in the 80s as a band, you think, if they had not taken the initial journey that they took from Chicago Transit Authority all the way through the 70s? Because it's just such an interesting trip. Like, you know, you guys early on talked about Robert Lamb, and it's just like the idea that Robert Lamb could write a song called Harry Truman and make it so hooky and engaging and pleasant to the ears. Like, so they just were playing in so many different pools in the 70s. Like, so how much do you think that carries over to what they were doing in the 80s? Like, you know, is there things that in your mind informed what they ultimately did in the 80s from where they began here so many years ago?
So what you're asking is if David Foster wouldn't have screwed up over and over from Chicago 18 on the production side, would it fit into
I tell you
any
what,
of
I don't know that that's what
albums?
I was asking,
is that what
but
you're asking?
That's a great thing to ponder. Let's take that journey.
Or Niagara Falls, Niagara Falls, you know, without David Foster, would that fit? Maybe. You know, you might need Terry Kaft to come in there with a few notes, but you know,
that's
I think
really interesting to ponder, Nick. Like, because like we think about the new Billy Joel song that came out this year, and how somebody on YouTube, like, you know, I think it was actually Fernando Perdomo, made like the what this song would sound like if Phil Ramone had produced it. Like, so imagine if we had the stems for those '80s Chicago's records, and like what the '80s Chicago records would sound like if James William Guercio had produced them instead. Like, I would love to hear that.
Right. The first thing is just swipe all the fiddles. It was an interesting time if you came up then, you know, and those were the first records you listened to, you know, because that was the sound of the day. So it wouldn't have jumped out. And I, the thing that I always say, I always want ponder is why a band like Chicago took such a hit for doing the same thing that all the other bands did. I mean,
because they never stopped. That's
but I mean, Heart, you know, Heart didn't stopped. Sound like they did in 1985 when they started.
Right. But at the end of that period, I like that Matt brought up Hornsby, because there are two things you can do when the hits dry up. You can either keep flailing at that brass ring, or you can say, okay, now I'm going to do what I want to do. And that's what Heart did after Desire Walks On. You know, every band, every act in Chicago's peer group did what they did. You're right. I think if that's all it is, and people still pounced on that era as like the worst of the worst, then that would be unfair. But Chicago never stopped doing that. Well into the late 90s and beyond. I mean, Chicago 30, they're still acting like it's 1989 or whatever. I don't understand I don't understand the thinking behind that decision. I don't understand not looking at their new lot in the marketplace and saying, you know what? We had a good run. We are a reliable touring act. We can stay on the road for 6 months out of the year if we want. And we'll put out records that make us happy. I think if they had done that the way Heart did, then people would say, okay, there was this blip in time. It was very lucrative for them. It didn't satisfy us the way the early records did, but now there's this new era of Chicago and they're kind of blending everything together.
But we're still not forgiving you for 29 or 64.
No, never.
In the mid-80s. The remake of that is unconscionable. It cannot be forgiven. I don't care what you do.
Dreadful.
They could put out a really good record right now, and I would love it, but I'm not. That's not coming off the record ever. That's going to be on the bad side of the ledger forever. Yes, at the very top.
Jeff, you have some stuff at jefffitoblog.com. You've got a great book that we will, you know, link folks to. Nick, you've got a couple things, like, as we're kind of like looking here into the new year, like, your main focus this year has been the Journey Worlds Apart book that you put out, but you're got something else on deck as we go into the new year. So wanted to give you a chance to tell folks about that as we wrap up here.
Yeah, coming off Journey Worlds Apart, I'm writing a different kind of book. The Journey book was more of an encyclopedic timeline style book. Really tried to tell the history of every album and every tour. The new book is going to focus on the band and Bob Dylan, and take a more interpretive song-focused approach. And the idea is to connect the music that they made in the summer of 1967 and moving forward with music being made today, to talk about how what we now know as Americana emerged from a period in which it was very odd. It was a very unusual sound. The summer of 1976 was Sgt. Pepper's and Surrealistic Pillow, and Woodstock was on the horizon. Meanwhile, they're in a basement with mandolins and singing about Civil War characters. An odd thing happened on the way to the 21st century. The guys with the mandolins were the ones who really had the greatest impact on music. That sound, the sound that they were making, is the sound that ended up becoming a modern sound. It carried forward through the ages in a way that acid rock or psychedelia didn't. And so, thus the name of the book. It's going to be called Forever Young, subtitled How the Band and Bob Dylan Made the Only 60s Music That Still Matters.
Fantastic. Well, guys, this was a lot of fun. As I mentioned, we had a conversation with Chicago's Lee Locknane to talk about Chicago and Friends live at 55. Lee and I also dig into the 55th anniversary of the CTA album. So let's get into that conversation. We hope that you enjoy it. How's it going, man?
Pretty good. How are you doing?
Real good. Real good, man. It's I'm so excited. I know that a lot of people, I know I'm not alone because I just read Gary Graff's thing at Billboard. A lot of folks are excited about this new Live at 55, man. It's a great release.
Cool. Yeah, it's God, we did it over a year ago, last November, I think.
Yeah, I know. I was pretty excited, like, when I first saw you guys announce the shows, because one of the first people I saw that was involved was Steve Vai. And I'm like, is this a one-off? Is this a tour? Like, so it was really cool to see this come together and, you know, develop into the whole all-star thing that we're now hearing and seeing. Like, it must have been an experience putting this together, Lee.
It was. It was a lot more work than I've ever done on a TV show before. So it was quite involved. But as it turns out, it was great fun working with all these guys and hearing and listening to them speak and finding out how interested they were in having heard our music as they were growing up and then wanting to be involved with it, with the show. And Steve Vai, he was young when he first heard our stuff and was enthralled with Terry Kath. So I'm pretty sure that's the main reason why Steve Vai decided to do it with us. And he had fun, you know. Oh, my God, these guys are musicians.
Yeah, it was pretty easy to draw a line between Steve and Terry. Like, that one's not difficult. Like, and but there's some out of the box folks. Like, it's cool. You know, like Robert Randolph just jams. He just burns with you guys on Listen. That's a great version of Listen. Like, like, what was the experience like for you, like, rehearsing this set with the various guests? Like, how did that end of things kind of go down?
Mainly, I worked with them before the rehearsals and sent them the music that they were going to be playing. The actual rehearsal time was pretty minimal. We went through, because there were seven different artists to work with, we had two different rehearsal days and only went through the songs that they were involved in. And so played them one, two times, got ready for it. Here's, we're going to do it here. We're going to cut it off there. Bing, bang, bong, we're done. And we were ready for the show. So it was still like, oh my God, I hope this works out. Yeah. And it did, ultimately.
I think you have that feeling, as you know, Lee, because you guys have filmed a number of things over the years. You have that feeling when there aren't guest artists involved. You just hope that everything's going to work on the day that the cameras roll.
Correct. Yeah. Because normally we're not rolling cameras. We're just going out and playing a show, planting our feet and playing our music. So you, always when there's TV involved, it gets a little more intricate.
How did the voice play guys come into the mix? Because I think in kind of a cool way, that kind of honors like what you guys have done in the past with like, people always loved it when you guys would collaborate with the Beach Boys. And that kind of honors that period pretty well.
And I think that maybe where... Barry Summers got his idea to have a segment of the show that was just voices and as few instruments as possible. And the campfire, the way they actually had fire, a semblance of a fire on the screen. It looked like it was really burning. And of course, there was no fire. I think the fire marshal would have had a problem.
Probably so.
Probably so, but working with voice play was really cool. We put arrangements together for the four songs. So, and they have a certain way of working. We have our certain way of working. And then I just sort of worked with them and blended those two aspects. And I thought it came out really cool.
You know, there's a good amount of stuff from the first record in particular that you guys have continued to play over the years, which I think that kind of shows how that first album has endured with so many people. But, you know, whether it's the stuff from that first record that you don't normally play or just generally, what was kind of, you know, some of the stuff that was, I guess, more challenging for you all to rehearse, like be it with guest artists or otherwise?
The song from the second album, In the Country, that was sort of weird because there are so many changes and Robert wasn't quite ready when he saw how many changes there were when we played it through the first time. He was going, you know, this is not a blues tune. I gotta really dig in here. And he had a good time doing it, and it was fun working with him. And the ultimate result was very well done. He did a good job, and I'm happy with the result.
It was a real trip. Like, you know, In the Country is one that you mentioned, but also just hearing you guys play stuff like, again, from the roads less traveled, things like South California Purples and, you know, Poem 58. Like, what does it bring back for you, like playing stuff like that?
It takes me back to the beginning where that was the only stuff that we knew. We played that and then the second album every night because that's all we knew other than the club tunes that we used to do. So any time that we had left in the show, we would do like a Beatle tune or one of the R&B tunes that we used to do in the clubs. And those would finish out our shows or be in the midst of the show somehow. But as we started getting hits and getting more and more hits, people then started asking why we were doing a Beatles song at some point in our show because they hadn't heard another one of our hits that they wanted. They came to the show and wanting to hear. So that's when we realized that we had enough to really hold our own on stage.
At the same point, like a lot of bands, like you guys started out playing covers, like how do you think that kind of ultimately influenced, you know, now it's with a great amount of hindsight, how do you think that kind of ultimately influenced like the songs you guys ended up starting to write? Like how much did that play into those, you know, to the type of stuff you guys started to write?
I think quite a lot, because we would take songs and either play them exactly as they came off the radio or make arrangements. So we sort of, we started calling it Chicagoizing. And, you know, we would make a brand new arrangement that nobody had heard before, an original arrangement of an established hit. And those were a lot of fun to play. And fortunately, we don't have recordings of some of the ones that I would love to even talk about, but we have nothing to show what it sounded like. I just have my memory banks, and sometimes they fail me.
How did you and Jimmy and I guess Walt kind of jive when it came to like doing arrangements? Because, you know, starting to be able to arrange stuff, that's a skill. So like where did that come from in the early days?
Jimmy was writing the brass arrangements back then. And then once we sat down, he would get down on paper, and then we would play it through and find out if the chords were the proper configuration that we needed to fill out the chord properly. And we would go through that until we had the right parts, and just one thing after another. And it was amazing because we were able to sound to have. Sometimes most of the time when we recorded, we would add another track and change the voicing from one, from the first generation to the second generation. So we would have six notes on there sometimes. And then when we played live, we still only had the three guys. So we had to get the right voicing to make it sound like there were six guys playing. And I'm often amazed, like when I did the Carnegie Hall live project, that it actually does sound bigger than three guys. It's like, how did we do that? You just keep going until it sounds right. That's the answer.
And if we stay with the studio thing, that like had to be an interesting thing, just wrapping your head around the concept of multi-track recording. Cause like, it's like already your creative brain, like once you discover there's this thing called multi-track recording, that opens up a lot in your brain. Like, okay, we already know we can do this, but now can also do this, you know?
Exactly. And then, you know, it gets to the point where there are so many tracks, you can do unlimited things. And then it really gets back to the basics of, if you record something on a song and it doesn't move the song along, erase it and move on.
Yeah.
You know, no matter how many tracks you have, if you just keep putting stuff on, it's just going to be stuff, not something that really relates to the furtherance of the song.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say, is like those early records in particular, like there's a benefit that you presumably at the beginning had less tracks, like, so you had to figure more things out.
That is exactly correct. We had to actually make decisions like the Beatles did. They had, you know, maybe 2 4-track machines linked together. So they were doing what was called sound on sound. They would fill up the tracks, even if they started with the 4 tracks, which they probably did before they could link 2 machines together. They would start with 4 tracks and fill up the first 3 and then combine that first 3. And when they were doing the 4th track, make a mix of what they thought those first three tracks were going to sound like by the time they finished mixing, and sort of an idea of how many more tracks they needed to accomplish that. And then record that 4th track with the first 3 combined. And then they'd have 3 more tracks open.
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating when you hear about how some of these records were made.
Yeah, exactly. And that's how they were all made when the track availability was what it was. Our first album was on an 8-track machine. And then I think we used either 2 8s or the 16-track machine had been invented by the second album. So we had, you know, more things where we could do stereo drums and stuff like that. When you do stereo drums, you're taking up a lot of tracks right off the bat.
So for sure.
You think we can do a vocal today? What do you think?
I mean, what do you remember, like, you know, as you're going into like record that first record, like, are you far enough along that like there were albums that you had already been listening to that from a production standpoint, you were going, it'd be great if we could get something that sounds like this sonically?
I don't know if we necessarily did it that way other than have the song rehearsed to the point where the writer would bring it in and then sort of turn it over to us. As we played it, we would start thinking of ways of furthering the song along. And then by the time we got into the studio, we'd have the track pretty well together. And we would record the brass parts at the same time. And then knowing full well that we were going to re-record the brass, but it's going to be the same notes. So it wouldn't matter if you could hear it in the background, because
the bleed
was going to be heard, whether you liked it or not. So if the parts were the same, it wouldn't matter at all. It'd just be sort of a compilation of what we're already going to be doing.
Collectively, what do you kind of appreciate about this first Chicago record now, 55 years later?
We were well rehearsed with the songs, and it was just a matter of learning how to record and beginning to be more comfortable in the studio and having that mic right in front of you and feeling that the pressure of not making a mistake. And you have to get away from that not making a mistake thing to just playing.
Yeah, and it's just interesting on a lot of levels, man, because like they're just, in theory, there are so many reasons on paper why a double LP debut from a band with horns should not have worked.
Correct. Who are these guys? Why should we play this? All of those things, you mean? Something like that?
Yeah, absolutely. Yep.
Why are you trying to make us do something we never do?
Exactly.
They literally said that because we hadn't had a hit yet, they couldn't play the song. Wait a minute. That's the catch 22 here. You know, how are we going to have a hit if you don't try it? So it took to the second album when they, and we were, the critics loved us initially with the first album. These guys are way far ahead of their time. Oh my God, what do they have for the second one? And then we came out with the second album, but AM radio didn't play the singles because they said we hadn't had a hit, blah, blah, blah. So we just kept going on the road playing schools and wherever else. We played everywhere across the country. And as we were writing the second album, which a lot of, we were rehearsing those songs on the road, which I was able to show in Carnegie Hall and especially in the Kennedy
JFK
Center.
Set. Yeah.
Yeah. There, we were rehearsing those songs for the next album that we were going to be recording about a week after we finished that particular show. And we hadn't figured out who was going to sing the lead vocals and stuff like that. So to do a major concert and still rehearsing songs, I'm going, how do we have the stones to try to pull that off? But it was really the only time that we could work on the songs because we were always gone. We were always working. And we came home, worked out pretty good, figured out who was going to sing, and there you go.
There's almost kind of a benefit, the pace that you guys were keeping, that you didn't have too much time to deliberate, like, you know, certain elements and overthink songs and arrangements and stuff like that. Like, there's a benefit that at a certain point you record the stuff, it's done, you have to go back out on the road and you just have to leave it. You have to leave it there.
Except we didn't leave it there. We kept developing the songs as we played the concerts after it was recorded. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, but like you have to cut the cord at a certain point just recording-wise. So wasn't there a benefit there?
Well, I'm not sure if it's called a benefit or you have no choice. The time's up, you're done. Let go. You know, that's
I've just
it.
Talked to people before where they've gone, if I didn't have a deadline, I'd still be recording the album, you know?
Unfortunately, that's probably true. And then, you know, the $18 million album is finally done.
Last few things from my side, like, you know, we kind of talked a little bit about you and Jimmy and Walt, but if we go back to like the early, early days, like DePaul University, like how do you meet Jimmy and Walt? Like what did those early times look like before the three of you started to play together? I guess, what were the things beyond the instrumentation, perhaps, that bonded you three?
Walt was already going to school there, and he played with a band called the Missing Links, and I would go in and sit in with those guys. And Terry was playing bass with the Missing Links. And when their career sort of faltered and they realized they weren't going to be making it any further than they already were, they wanted to form a new band. And me and Jimmy, we would hear Jimmy practicing in the practice rooms at DePaul University. And I guess Walt asked him if he wanted to be in the band. And he obviously said yes. He went to a club on the south side and saw Robert playing with, he was calling himself Bobby Charles and the Wanderers. I think it was the Wanderers.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, and then asked him if he wanted, and asked him if he knew how to play bass pedals on an organ. And he said, oh, yeah. And he had never done that in his life. So, but he said he could. He came in, and for the first 6-8 months that we were together, he was playing bass pedals on his MA, or I don't even know what the organs are called. But he was playing bass pedals, and that doesn't cut through as well as a bass guitar. So once Cetera came in and joined the band, and he wanted to leave his little band, we sort of had a battle of the bands one time, and I think we ended up winning. That was with a band called The Exceptions. But that's how we got the band together, and then we started playing clubs around the area, and the reputation grew, and then we moved out to California, and you know the rest.
Yeah, I was going to say, man, like those early gigs in the Chicago area seemed like they would have been formative. Like, how do you think that kind of molded what the band became, and how did the move to California further affect things?
We actually had no idea what was going to happen. We just went out to California thinking that hopefully something will happen. And we just kept playing the songs that we knew, and we were playing, top 40 songs, covers of top 40 songs, and then we were taking arrangements. We listened to the Vanilla Fudge, who were in fact doing arrangements of other people's hits or hits that were already established, and they do a different arrangement of it. And that's where we started doing the same thing. And that was our development into, once we got on record, combining different aspects of music and combining them all together in one song.
And legendarily, like, the group got to play with Hendrix, like, and it's a time where playing shows like the one with Jimmy, sometimes for some bands, like, those feel like contemporaries because the band guys are young. There's often egos involved, but how much did it feel like something more than that, the experience of playing with somebody like Jimi Hendrix?
Well, mainly the when we played with Jimi Hendrix, we went on first, obviously, and the audience was more interested in hearing Jimmy. So there was a lot of put Jimmy on stage chants rather than listening to us. But I think enough people recognized and enjoyed hearing what we were doing that it was, these guys aren't so bad. Yeah, and we were coming out, we were set up in this little tiny group up on stage. There was probably a 40-foot stage, and we were used to coming out of the club, so we were already tight together. And that's the way we configured ourselves on the bigger, when we first went out with Janis Joplin and Jimi Hendrix. So it had to look pretty, why are those guys just sort of standing together like that, so close? We didn't know any other way of doing it at that point.
Bringing things back to this current Live at 55 release, Chicago and Friends, man, it's impressive. This thing runs 2 hours and 24 minutes, and I have seen you guys play a set around that length, So I wonder for you, as the trumpet player, man, where do you get the stamina at this point? It's pretty incredible to see you go out and do a show like that.
It's the keep practicing aspect. You either keep practicing or it starts going the opposite way. And you have to have sort of something to practice and a vision of where you want to go with it. And if you don't have those things, you either stay static or start reverting back to something where you don't want to be. And so I just keep trying to move forward. And also the thing that helps me is talking to people who have been influenced by what I did, which I never considered as I was doing it, or probably any of us did, that it would influence someone else to not only get in the business, but surpass what it was that I was doing. And so that made me work harder, and it still does today.
Yeah, you don't have a lot of bands where it's like something like the Chicago Horns. Like, we started seeing you guys pop up on some other people's projects, and it's like there's not a lot of times outside of like something like Tower of Power and some other folks that we can name that like it becomes such a marquee thing that that's worth something that people are like, we want to get these guys on our record. So that says a lot right there.
Exactly. And we did a couple of those too. And I think we sort of priced ourselves out of the market. I think Jimmy and Walt particularly wanted to get more than other people were willing to pay. And there was other, you know, horn players that could play parts. So I think that sort of took us back to just being Chicago.
You guys are always working musically. What is there in the realm of like new music that's taking shape?
I know there's songs being written. There aren't any plans right now specifically to go in and record together. And I don't know if it'll be something that we do in everybody's individual home record
Sure.
setups or not. Hopefully we'll be able to get together in a studio and actually, you know, work like we always used to. But those days might be gone. I don't know. You might have to just, you know, put the records together and make it sound like we're all in the studio together. But, you know, time will tell. We'll keep working at it. That's for sure.
For sure. And I've liked seeing you say it. I think basically you've said something to the effect of that, like, you plan like some of your heroes, you know, that you saw earlier on, like Duke Ellington band and, you know, just Count Basie Orchestra and all that kind of stuff to play till you drop. But it's like, I think that's kind of the thing that really is impressive to me watching this Live at 55 thing is just the stamina overall for the band. So I wonder, like, what does the band Chicago look like someday if there's not you, Robert, and Jimmy? Like, how much of a chance is there in your view that we would see Chicago continue onward?
I don't see why it won't continue onward in the fact that the music has really sustained us. And if there's anything that really comes to mind as to why we're still on the road, it's because people grew up with that music and then they come, and who knows why they come to the show. They might come to see, these guys have been together so long, I want to see how bad it's going to be. They can't possibly be better than they were when they were kids. And when they find out that we can still play well and it's really a good show, they want to come back again. And this has happened at where we inspired other generations of people to come in. Even when they couldn't admit to their friends that they liked us, they liked it and came to the shows. So it's really, I think, attributed to the music and how we perform consistently year after year. And we've never taken a year off. I think it's, 58 years now. And we, even during COVID, we worked the first couple months of 2020. And then when the world shut down, we didn't work for 15 months, but we were working in 2021 when it was April or May, whenever the hell that was that we started back. And so we worked that year as well. So the consecutive year after year working never stopped for us. And I'm quite proud of that. If I decided to retire, I was thinking, retire to what? There is no job that you can get that is anywhere near close to this. Why stop? And everybody enjoys the music. Why change that?
I agree, man. Well, Lee, it is always a pleasure. Thank you so much for the time. And thank you for all the music that you and the guys have given us over the years, man. It's always a pleasure to see you guys.
Thanks, Matt. Great talking to you.
There you have it. Another episode of the UCR Podcast is in the books. I am Matt Wardlaw. Thank you so much to all of you for listening. Please make sure to follow this podcast if you haven't, so you will get future episodes as they're released. And we'd appreciate it also if you would rate and review the podcast wherever you're listening. Look, we are all music fans, so if you enjoyed this, you can find a lot more at ultimateclassicrock.com, and we'll see you there.